This is an ABC podcast.
Hey Siri, what does smart mean?
As an adjective, it means of a person, clean, tidy, and well-dressed. Do you want to hear the next one?
Yes, please.
This is an informal term. As an adjective, it means having or showing a quick-witted intelligence.
This is Lost and Found. I'm Jonathan Green. This week, smart. Hey Siri, are you smart?
Well, a wise man once said, I am so smart. S-M-R-T.
Maybe not so smart. Genevieve Bell is a distinguished professor at the Australian National University College of Engineering and Computer Science. Genevieve, suddenly we are surrounded by machines that we have invested with intelligence.
Well, we've certainly invested them with something. I'm not always sure it was intelligence. And we've used the phrase, you know, smart, fill in the blank, smart printer, smart lights. I mean, that kind of appellation in front of technology objects. We've been talking about that for at least 20 years, and what it has meant has varied over time. But for me, it's always interesting to imagine what's the contrast, right? So when we first started talking about smartphones, I always wondered what that meant the other phones were. Like, not smart. And if so, what was the kind of what was the hurdle you needed to get over to make something smart? And then, you know, of course, Jonathan, you're asking the right question, right? Which is not only what did that mean for us, but I think how did that make us kind of feel about those objects? You know, how do you feel if the technological object is smart and maybe it makes you feel less smart?
Devices now have the capacity to learn from their experience. And this is going to escalate, and this will, as technology does, escalate beyond perhaps our capacity to think about it in the world. And we will, as a result of that sort of process, wake up one day when our place in the universe has shifted.
Oh, absolutely. And in some ways, I suspect it will be more both subtle and tacit than we imagine. I mean, I was struck by thinking about the way elevators have become smart, right? You know, they are now connected, they're collecting data, they're able to predict traffic patterns in a building, they anticipate when people are going to leave the building, when they have become, you know, Douglas Adams' kind of vision of the elevators being prescient. But now imagine that you have many things in the built world around you that are acting maybe on your behalf, maybe on someone else's behalf around you. I was at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas a month ago, and on display there was an appliance company who was showing a smart washing machine and dryer that would be both connected to the internet but connected to each other. And the washing machine over time would learn how you like to set the settings for washing your clothes and had a capacity to talk to the dryer about what it had done to the clothes in order for the dryer to better anticipate what to do with them when they got to the dryer. And there was something about the world that imagined that was at best unnerving.
Because this is the thing, our world has evolved around us and our capacity. It's been a very organic and human thing. We've created cities that have come to reflect us. This has been the sort of the pattern of our urban civilization. Now suddenly the city is perhaps thinking for itself, and perhaps thinking for itself in a way that serves needs other than those of the inhabitants.
Well, I think you have to be careful when you use the word itself. The city is probably a constellation of technologies which may have different agendas. I think what might be a change is what other interests come into play here. So say that you have a kind of a vision of a smart city and an implementation of it where the electrical grid is optimized around one set of things and you have a capacity to kind of, you know, reach down into a household, an individual household, and change the energy profile. You've got a transportation system that's rationalizing where cars go. You may have third-party providers who are sitting inside that grid who are doing any number of things. I mean, there's a court case that's been going on in America, in the state of Illinois, I believe, that had to do with traffic lights that had been made smart, and it had to do with the amount of time the traffic lights went through red, amber, green. And what was happening was that in any given month, the traffic light was varying the amount of time it was spent in amber. And why that became relevant was that for the policing in that city, red light runners were a revenue source. And so diminishing the amount of time the traffic lights spent in amber meant you could raise more money. But the people who were controlling the traffic lights were not part of the state apparatus. They were a third-party provider who were changing the traffic lights in order to drive profits. And the lawsuit kind of unfolded in two ways, right? One was that there was a citizen of the city in which this had happened going, I don't think those traffic lights are behaving the same way every day. And it takes a certain kind of person with a stopwatch to work that out.
Bless them.
Who then sued the city on the basis of that. But then what unfolded behind that was this piece about what it meant to have an infrastructure that was provisioned to citizens being controlled by a party who wanted to profit off of it, where the profit and the deployment of the traffic light were all kind of a complex interweaving. So then scale that up, Jonathan, and imagine what it might mean to have smart cities where there are lots of other interests. So it's not only uneven, but the kind of the players in the ecosystem aren't always apparent either. And so for me, the kind of there are these big complicated questions that emerge as whole systems become smart that are about privacy and security and trust and risk and fairness. And how does all of that get regulated and monitored and ultimately possibly policed?
Genevieve Bell.
Hey Siri, what's a smart city?
A smart city is an urban area that uses different types of electronic data collection sensors to supply information which is used to manage assets and resources efficiently. Do you want me to keep reading?
Oh yes, please.
This includes data collected from citizens, devices, and assets that is processed and analyzed to monitor and manage traffic and transportation systems, power plants, water supply networks, waste management, law enforcement, information systems, schools, libraries, hospitals, and other community services.
Dr. Jathan Sadowski is a postdoctoral research fellow in the School of Architecture, Design and Planning at the University of Sydney. Jathan, smart urbanism, snappy expression, what does it mean?
That's a very good question, and one that a lot of people, including governments and many of the companies that are kind of leading this movement and selling the different services, are still trying to figure out themselves. There's really no generally agreed upon, holistic definition, but we can kind of understand smart urbanism as the use of often data-driven, network-connected, and automated technologies in the urban environment, urban society, and city government.
Take us to a world-leading example. Take us perhaps to what's happening in Toronto.
Sure. So what's happening in Toronto has definitely captured a lot of people's attention. And that's a partnership between Sidewalk Labs, which is the urban innovation arm of Alphabet, which is itself the parent company of Google. So Sidewalk is this kind of sister company, this offshoot of Google. And they're working right now with the city of Toronto, and particularly a kind of tri-level, local, federal, and state-level government agency there called Waterfront Toronto that's in charge of developing this neighborhood called the Quayside District. So right now, Sidewalk and Waterfront Toronto are trying to figure out how they're going to turn this Quayside District into a smart city or a smart district that Sidewalk, the company, kind of oversees and develops and packs it full of all kinds of experimental technologies, experimental planning techniques and building techniques and sensors, lots of data, lots of automation happening, and kind of turn this into a model for how they might develop cities in other places around the world. And it seemed to be this kind of handover, Toronto just handing over this whole district to Sidewalk and saying, run wild, do what you want, and hopefully something good out of it comes for the city and for the citizens in Toronto.
Which is an interesting point, because I mean, when these sorts of organizations are involved, the Googles of the world, we assume a certain benevolent intent, but the truth of it is that we are handing over great areas of public space and public infrastructure to commercial interest.
Exactly. And for a long time, Silicon Valley and these technology companies have kind of ridden off of this benevolence by default, right? We assume that the things that they're building are going to lead to progress, they're going to enhance our lives, kind of move society forward. But lately, there has definitely been what's been called a tech lash. And I think rightfully so, from the public as well as from kind of journalist and media scrutiny and government scrutiny at these big technology companies, because ultimately we recognize that they are private interests and yes, they are some of the wealthiest companies ever to exist in the world.
But in taking their work out of the desktop and into actual
the urban environment. They're simply taking advantage of a social and market failure, are they not? I mean, this is infrastructure which could be provided by us, by the state, and yet we choose to co-opt private enterprise into this.
It's a failure of sorts, and I think it's a failure that has the groundwork has been set for a while. When we look at the effects of austerity on city governments, where budgets have been slashed, but cities themselves are still growing. Infrastructure is quickly getting out of date. It's out of maintenance. And all this has been compounded by the still ravishing effects of the global financial crash. 10 years plus onward, we're still seeing the effects of that. And so it's kind of provided this opening for these big platforms, these big companies, not just Google, but also think about Uber, right, to be able to kind of come into a city and attempt to swallow an entire sector around transportation. There are reports of city governments saying that they're not going to put funding towards public transportation because Uber provides an alternative service that people use. And that itself is a total privatization. We start seeing these kind of core functions of the city being handed over to private interest. So now it's, the smart city kind of started with companies like IBM and Cisco, these legacy companies, taking over part of the oversight of cities, helping governments provide them with data, with control rooms, with these smart solutions that help governments and planners oversee the city. Then we start seeing these platforms come in and start taking over parts of the operations of the city, these core functions. And now I think with the Sidewalk Labs example, in Toronto, we start seeing a move towards ownership. Right now, the cities are looking to say, if we're going to help you oversee the city, if we're going to help you operate the city, then we want an ownership stake in the city.
But we do this with that same exchange that we've become accustomed to in this time. We gave over friendship to Facebook, and acknowledged that the exchange was a sacrifice of our privacy. Now we give over our cities to similar organisations, acknowledging that there's a similar trade-off. And yet we hope that the benefit will be more substantial.
Right. And what we've learned from the Facebook example is that there's always these hidden costs, these kind of secondary, tertiary effects that we never intended and we never foresaw by handing over something like friendship to Facebook or like the infrastructure and services of our city to Google. There's a lot of faith involved, and I don't think that faith is founded. I don't think that we have a reason to put our faith in them so blindly.
So when the modern city is fully Googled, what does it become?
That's a very good question, and one that definitely lends itself to some dystopian views of thinking of a city that on the outside is this very highly data driven, highly connected, shiny city of the future, but there's this underbelly where it's corporate run, and which means that it's run in the interest of private profit. It's run counter to kind of democratic ideals and are replaced instead by technocratic systems, right? And a lot of that becomes really difficult to put concrete, here's what it's going to look like. But instead, what we can do is point to certain things that are already happening and say, is that the kind of city or the kind of society we want to live in, right? So thinking about things like democratic participation in decision-making in our cities, that's a core ideal that we see as something that citizens have a right to have a say in how their cities are run and who they're run for. Replace that with more kind of corporate or more technocratic models where that participation starts eroding. It starts being replaced by marketing terminology around public engagement and focus groups where, you know, we're going to gather your viewpoints and make it appear as if you have a say in what's going on. But in reality, we're still going to do what we want, which is not something we want to see become part of the nominally democratic governance of a city.
Jathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Jathan Sadowski, he's from the School of Architecture, Design and Planning at the University of Sydney. Hey Siri, what's a smart home?
Home automation or domotics is building automation for a home, called the smart home or smart house. Would you like to hear more?
Yes, please.
A home automation system will control lighting, climate, entertainment systems, and appliances. It may also include home security such as access control and alarm systems. When connected with the internet, home devices are an important constituent of the Internet of Things. A home automation system typically connects controlled devices to a central hub or gateway.
Yolandi Stringers is Associate Professor of Digital Technology and Society at the Emerging Technologies Lab at Monash University. Yolandi, if I say to you smart home, what's conjured in your mind by that expression?
It is such a broad term, and the way I've approached it in my research is to sort of let my participants, so the people who live in smart homes, tell me what it means to them. There's lots of different ways of defining it. There's also lots of different technologies. You know, you can walk into a shop now and buy a smart light bulb yep. off the shelf, but you can also spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to create what's called a system integration and really build a sort of whiz-bang smart home, if you like, that has all the bells and whistles. So there's a very broad spectrum.
What's out there at that sort of bells and whistles end of the spectrum? What sort of things are now possible?
Well, you can basically have your home controlled more or less entirely through some sort of touch system or voice system. So if you have, for example, a Google Home or an Amazon Alexa, you can talk to those devices and ask them to do pretty much anything you would do in a home, like, you know, turn the microwave on now, or the lights or the air conditioning or the TV, or, you know, do play some music, all those sorts of
things. Feed the cat.
Yeah. There is a limit. Certainly, it's maybe not as far, going as far as some of the sci-fi depictions of the smart home might have us believe. But there is a lot that you can do.
I wonder what are we trying to save ourselves from, or what are we trying to facilitate with those sorts of interventions? I wonder.
Well, it's an interesting industry. It's often talked about as a set of solutions in search of their problem, in the sense that, you know, we have a lot of devices that maybe the appeal or the purpose of them isn't that clear to a lot of consumers and people out there. But in the research we've done with people who use smart home technologies and live in smart homes, there's a sort of what they talk about it in terms of the little small conveniences they bring. And, you know, it might not sound like much of a difference to talk to an appliance as opposed to, you know, pressing buttons. But that is, you know, over time those things do add up and add a sort of enhanced quality of life to the people that we speak to. I mean, we all know how frustrated we get over remote controls. And to just be able to talk to, you know, something and say, do this, provided it does it seamlessly, which is, you know, definitely one of the issues. But that there is a certain appeal to that for many people.
You mentioned Alexa, who is, of course, a woman. What's the rationale for feminizing that sense of the intelligent presence in a smart home?
There is actually a lot of research sitting behind that, and most of it has to do with the fact that we find the female voice and just the feminine form in general more likable and more trustworthy. So there's a good reason why companies that many people are cautious of, because they do collect and, you know, large amounts of data, why they've sort of feminized those smart home technologies.
And yet there's a subtext to that as well that says that, you know, the domestic aide in my new smart home will necessarily be female.
That's right. So there's stereotypes there being reinforced as well, which I think is problematic. And what it's sort of doing is saying that this domestic role, which has always been or traditionally been performed by a woman, is being re-established as a woman's role or reinforced as a woman's role, which, you know, many people who are arguing for a more equal distribution of those domestic responsibilities would find a little bit troubling.
When, in particular, when so many of the things which we would bracket under smart home
speak to perhaps sort of masculinized aspects of domestic activity?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the interesting things about the smart home, it is a very male-dominated industry from multiple angles. I mean, engineering is still very male-dominated, as is computer science. It's actually one of the worst for gender imbalance and as far as professions and disciplines go. And, of course, that does feed through into what kinds of technologies get designed and what ends up in homes. And one of the criticisms of the smart home has been that it's been very focused on, you know, sort of typical men's or stereotypical men's interests. It's had a sort of fascination with audio visual equipment, for example, rather than genuinely useful domestic appliances that can alleviate the work that is still more likely to fall to women than men. So there's a lot of catch-up going on at the moment in the industry in terms of, I guess, thinking more seriously about technologies that might be of interest to both genders and have that wider appeal and that sense of usefulness. The other gender angle, there's a lot of extra work that often comes with having a smart home. So even though it's promised to make our lives easier and simpler, what we find in our research with people who live with these technologies is that it actually increases what's called digital housekeeping. So that work, that labour, most often falls to men in the home. So that's another really good reason why we sort of need to address this gender imbalance in how these technologies are used and also the benefits that they might bring.
Yolandi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yolandi Stringers. Hey Siri, what's smart casual?
Smart casual is an ambiguously defined Western dress code that is generally casual wear but with additional components of a proper lounge suit from traditional informal wear. Would you like to hear more?
Oh yes, please.
Different localities, kinds of events, contexts, or cultures can have varying interpretations of the dress code, and therefore the designation of certain clothing pieces as smart casual is disputed, as its distinction, if any, from business casual.
Margaret Maynard is an associate professor at the University of Queensland. Margaret, when I see a little sign saying smart casual, I take that as, well, the owner of the establishment taking a fair bit of control over who they'll let in and who they won't. What does it actually mean?
Well, smart casual is a term that often appears at the bottom of invitations. For instance, if you are being asked to go to a wedding or some kind of convention in the evening, it's kind of one step up from just smart, in the sense that if you were going to a wedding maybe 50 years ago, you would wear a full suit. Nowadays, a man would wear perhaps a tie, but perhaps not, perhaps a jacket or not. But I think in some ways, smart casual is a new kind of use of the word. Hmm. It's coming in the last 20 years or so.
It's an interesting thing because, I would instantly imagine, you know, sort of a jacket chinos kind of thing. So
I think it's slightly up from that.
Oh, dear.
Well, I think like dark trousers maybe.
Okay.
And an unusual matching tie or something of that sort.
And for women, it's not quite a cocktail frock.
Well, I think it's one down from a cocktail frock, actually. Probably an ensemble, you know, either a dress with matching shoes or contrasting shoes that have been thought out very carefully. Or you might wear, nowadays, I think you can wear trousers and a sort of short jacket that have some sort of relationship to each other. Trousers, of course, have become much more popular in smart venues. Mm. So most women would wear high-heeled shoes. I think it's a good time for that. They perhaps have a clutch bag. And if you were going to the races, of course, you'd have a little fascinator or a hat. So smart casual is this kind of mixture of things.
Gee, I'm not sure where the casual is.
Well, it's formal. Yeah, it's a subtle thing. But formal dress is very different from casual formal if you get an invitation.
Well, Margaret, I feel distinctly underdressed for this occasion. I'm going to run away immediately and hide.
I was going to ask if you were smartly dressed first off.
Well, some would say, others may beg to differ. Margaret, thank you so much.
Okay.
Margaret Maynard, Associate Professor at the University of Queensland. You've been listening to Lost and Found, a Blueprint for Living production this week on Smart.
You heard Genevieve Bell, Distinguished Professor at the ANU College of Engineering and Computer Science. Dr. Jathan Sadowski, Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the School of Architecture, Design and Planning, the University of Sydney. Yolanda Strengers, Associate Professor of Digital Technology and Society Emerging Technologies Lab at Monash University. And Associate Professor Margaret Maynard, School of Communication and Arts, the University of Queensland. And Siri, what passes in my phone for intelligence. Producers are Mira Adley-Gillies and Sylvie Van Wall. Technical production by Chrissy Miltiardou. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.